Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show.
Today, we're launching a major effort to moderate the price of oil, an effort that will span the globe in its reach and ultimately reach your corner gas station, God willing.
That is the leader of the free world, Joe. I sometimes forget I'm President Biden, and this is the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to the best conversation in talk journalism, and you're welcome to sound off, too, especially if you're a naysayer. It's easy to do. 866-HEY-LARS, and bring your guts and a few facts and maybe a little bit of logic. If you want to email instead, they all come right to me, and if you get an answer, it comes from me, too. Talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our Twitter poll, and we've made that possible two ways on Twitter at Lars Larson Show. And on our website, if you don't like Twitter like me, you can go to LarsLarson.com. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 21 years. Yes, Joe Biden finally realized that high gas prices are a problem for Americans. Took a little while for the light bulb to come on. Just a week ago, Joe Biden actually announced, and he demonstrated just how dim he really is. He declared, "Why do you know that people in California might pay as much as $4.50 a gallon for gasoline?" He seemed amazed by that. Now, I know a president doesn't often tank up his own car, probably never. But the statewide average at the time Joe said that people in California might pay as much as $4.50 a gallon was already $4.62. And in some cities, it was almost $8 a gallon. Yes, Joe Biden is truly clueless until his minders, or whoever happens to be pulling the strings, probably Obama, tells him what he should say. And Joe also today, before he talked about his so-called solutions, and I'll explain why they don't work, he wanted to say, "Hey, I didn't do any of this. This wasn't my climate measures." Take a listen to that.
I also want to briefly address one myth about inflated gas prices. They're not due to environmental measures. My effort to combat climate change is not raising the price of gas or increasing its availability. What it's doing, it's increasing the availability of jobs. Jobs building electric cars like the one I drove at the GM factory in Detroit last week. For the hundreds of thousands of folks who bought one of those electric cars, they're going to save $800 to $1,000 in fuel costs this year.
Yeah, I know how much Joe Biden hates to let facts get in the way of a good political climate jihad, but electric cars are not going to save Americans anytime soon. So let me point out the actual numbers, because I don't think the president of the United States knows any of this, and I don't think his minders are trusting him with the information. There are, this year, 272 million privately owned cars in America. Now, I include pickup trucks, so those kinds of trucks. The government owns another 4 million vehicles. Electric cars, at last count this year, number just over 2 million. So I'll do the math for you. That is 2/3 of 1% of all the cars in America. So when Joe says, "Gee, if you're driving an electric car, well, you'll save $800 this year," that's assuming you're getting the electricity for free. They're really not that good a deal, and many of the bus companies are finding that out. But 2/3 of 1% are driving that kind of car, and the other 271.4 million people are driving a car fueled by gasoline or diesel. And by the way, most of those electric cars are built in China. So what does Joe do? Joe says, "We're going to simply go to the cupboard and we're going to get some of the emergency supplies of oil that America has, and we'll just flush that into the system." I'll tell you about the numbers on that in a moment. Here's the way Joe announced it today.
So today I'm announcing that the largest ever release from the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve to help provide the supply we need as we recover from this pandemic. In addition, I brought together other nations to contribute to the solution. India, Japan, Republic of Korea, and the United Kingdom have agreed to release additional oil from their reserves, and China may do more as well. This coordinated action will help us deal with a lack of supply, which in turn helps ease prices. The bottom line, today we're launching a major effort to moderate the price of oil, an effort that will span the globe in its reach and ultimately reach your corner gas station, God willing.
Now, I don't know how many of the major media are going to call out the pure BS, but get your barn boots ready and get your shovel because it is thick when Joe shovels it out. 50 million barrels is what he'll take out of our emergency reserves. I might point out that most of that oil was put into the reserves. We have about 600 million gallons or 600 million barrels of oil in the reserves. It was put in at very low price because oil prices were low not that long ago when America was self-sufficient under Donald Trump. He's now taking inexpensive oil and he's going to flush it out into the system. And when he replenishes that emergency supply, he's going to have to buy it at today's prices, which are much higher. Now, that seems kind of stupid, but 50 million barrels, you say, boy, Lars, that's a lot of oil. It is about the amount of oil that the United States uses in 2.5 days. Now, if you don't believe me, go look it up. America uses about 18 to 20 million barrels a day. So 50 million barrels is about 2.5 days. Now, if you've got any economists, they can actually do the math on that. If you take that minuscule amount of oil and you flush it into a system that has to continuously provide fuel for an entire country, how much is it going to reduce prices? It might, in a few weeks, drop prices for about 10 cents a gallon. And then it's going to go right back up, unless you can keep flushing another 50 million barrels into it every week or so, because it's not going to make a gigantic difference. But then Joe tries a really sneaky little trick. He talks about how this is just a spike in prices. And after all, other countries pay more money for gasoline. Listen to this.
In France, at the end of last month, it reached about $7 per gallon. In Japan, it's about $5.50 per gallon, the highest it's been in years. Of course, it's always painful when gas prices spike. Today, the price of gas in America on average is $3.40 a gallon. In California, it's much higher. The impact is real. But the fact is, we faced even worse spikes before. Just in the last decade, we saw it in 2012 when the price of gasoline hit $3.90.
Under Obama.
We saw it in 2014 when it hit $3.69.
Under Obama.
And as recently as 2019, we saw it surpass $3 in many places. The fact is, we always get through those spikes, but we're going to get through this one as well and hopefully faster.
Now, let me tell you what's sneaky about that when he talks about the cost of gas in Japan or in France or anywhere else. For the most part, gasoline costs the same amount of money in every single country except for one thing, taxes. Taxes are dramatically higher in Europe. They're dramatically higher in Japan. The actual gasoline costs about the same amount of money almost everywhere in the world. There's a little bit of difference for transportation, a little bit for refining, but the differences between Western Europe and the United States, they're almost entirely because of taxation. So when he says, well, they're paying $7 and you're only paying 3.5, he is playing a game with your head and you shouldn't let him do it. Coming up next, on the Radio Northwest Network, we'll talk about the Waukesha, Wisconsin Christmas Parade murders and how they could come home to our communities in the Northwest.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Well, the Waukesha, Wisconsin Christmas Parade murders ought to horrify us. Really, they horrify me. But if we're honest, we need to admit that officials are pushing the same policies here in the Northwest that let a criminal slam his SUV through human bodies of innocent people on Sunday night in Waukesha. In both Seattle and Portland, prosecutors refuse to prosecute. Terrorists from Antifa commit assault and often walk out of police custody soon enough to jump right back into the same fight the very same day. City officials tie the hands of police. If you don't believe me, last Friday night's violent post-Kenosha Portland riot resulted in what? 5 tickets, 14 warnings, and not one single arrest. Seattle has a list of frequent flyer criminals who inhabit its downtown area, and they go in and out and in and out of the system dozens of times. And the bad guys, well, they may be dumb in some ways, but they get the message. When there are no consequences for the criminals, they're free to do more of the same. Record numbers of shootings and homicides have been the result. The accused Christmas parade killer is a good example. Daryl Brooks has a 20-year history of crime, and he's still not locked up. Earlier this year, he shot at his nephew with a pistol. $500 bail, and he's out of jail. Last week, police say he beat a woman, it may have been the mother of one of his children, and then he ran over her with his car. Thankfully, she survived but was badly hurt. $1,000 bail, and he's out yet again, leaving him free Sunday night to allegedly plow his SUV right down the main street of Waukesha, crushing people and sending children flying. Horrible, you say, and you're right. But remember, the prosecutors and the governors you elected are doing the very same thing here in the Northwest until enough blood spills to get people to object. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, usually I have the name of the person that I'm going to award the grill to. You'll understand why I don't have the name, but we may know the name at some point. In Newburgh, Oregon, classes were delayed this morning. After a social media post caused alarm, and probably rightly so. The district says the post included a picture of a handgun. It turned out later that it was an airsoft gun, but you couldn't see that necessarily, with the words, "Don't come to school today." Police have arrested the person who posted it for disorderly conduct. Not terroristic threats, disorderly conduct. There's no word yet whether that person is a student or not. I have a feeling if it's a student, if it's a juvenile, there will be very few consequences at all. We will never learn the name of the person, and we should know the name of the person who gives a threat like that, that causes a school to be closed down. We're already told that the kids are shortchanged when it comes to education because of the pandemic. We're told that even though we spend billions and billions of dollars, we spend north of $15,000 per kid per year for K-12 public education. And we're told there's not enough time to teach the kids everything they need to know. We're also told that you can get a graduation certificate called a diploma from high schools in Oregon by state law. You can still get a diploma even if you can't read, can't write, and can't do math. And then we have an entire school shut down in one community because somebody posts a terroristic threat. Should there be tough consequences for that person? I would say so. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS on the Radio Northwest Network. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, our best email of the day, and I'll give you the background on why the gentleman sent it to me, but it's brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest, now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Online, find them at rivercityusa.com/careers. Now, yesterday, I talked about the fact that the state police, in this case in Oregon, although I have every reason to believe the cartels may be operating their marijuana factories in Washington state as well, and it really is a factory size operation. The state police seized 500,000 pounds, 500,000 pounds of marijuana. They put the value at about $500 million, so $500 million worth of pot. And if you say, well, that's something new, no, Kate Brown has known about this for years. Her own Oregon State Police wrote a report that Kate did her best to bury that said that about $1 billion worth of illegal pot leaves the state every year. So it doesn't get taxed, it's not regulated, and they take it to other states where they can sell it for more money. And I said, if you're allowing criminal enterprises, now whether it's a Mexican drug cartel or some other criminal enterprise, how big do you have to be to rent multiple industry-sized buildings to grow 500,000 pounds of pot and then somehow distribute it? I would say that enterprise would have to be a fairly big one. And the fact is, the powers that be, like the Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum and Kate Brown, the governor, do not want to go after this. They get a lot of donations from the legal marijuana crowd, and they don't want to make themselves appear to be anti-pot. I got this email from Tony. Lars, I was listening Monday. Just add some fire to your argument about criminal-run marijuana farms in Oregon. In Klamath County, we've had numerous busts with grows this summer when farmers get no water for their own legitimate crops. These grow sites are illegally, in many cases, stealing the water and then, quote, growing hemp, laugh out loud. In addition to the many illegal grow sites raided this summer, in the last couple of months, the police have nabbed approximately $150 million in processed and drying marijuana. It's truly an epidemic in the southwestern counties in Oregon, and the state and the feds need to provide needed support for the four southwest counties in Oregon to curb this takeover of our farmland by cartels based in Mexico. I do not think that many arrests were made in these busts. Most, as I say, are run with from Mexico with slave labor. And we've talked about the slave labor problem on this program before. Until the state makes the owners of these facilities and farm liable for what's happening on their property or comes up with massive amounts of money, the drug problem's going to skyrocket. We, too, were approached by some shady characters about renting our property, 300-plus acres, to grow hemp and use our 10,000-square-foot building on the property to dry hemp. They offered a pretty penny in the thousands and thousands to rent the ground. All of us, my brothers and my sisters, had a funny feeling about these guys when they told us how much money was behind them coming from outside the USA and did not take them up on the formidable amount of money that they offered up. Our family has too much to lose and a reputation to keep in our community. Signed, Tony B. Now, it's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And coming up in a moment, I'm going to tell you a bit more about what's going on with the district attorney in Waukesha. And you should be aware there are district attorneys just as bad right here in the Northwest. And at some point, it's going to cost lives. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. By the way, some developments today. The state of Oregon came out, and it did something that, like many of the things the state and Kate Brown do, is mostly meaningless. Oregon has now lifted its outdoor face mask requirement for crowded settings. Now, I don't know, when I go out in public, I don't see a lot of people wearing masks out of doors. So I think Kate Brown finally decided it didn't make much sense to have a requirement that wasn't being followed by the vast majority of people. Now, there will always be those people, and you and I probably all, we see them all the time. They're driving down the road, driving a car. It's not an Uber or a Lyft. And they're driving their car, and they're wearing a face mask in their own car when they're sitting in a car all by themselves. Now, for those people, I'm sure they'll be wearing a mask well into 2050. They'll wear a mask for the rest of their lives. Okay, fine, that's your choice. But the state health authority said the rule was implemented in August during a surge of cases and hospitalizations brought on by the Delta variant of COVID-19. This decision takes effect immediately and reflects the overall progress we've seen on COVID-19. No, it probably more likely affects the fact that nobody was doing it anyway, or few people were doing it, other than the people who, even after government someday lifts all the mask requirements for all situations, I have a feeling there will be some people who will still be wearing a mask at that point. And if they want to do that, that's fine. It then becomes easy to see who are the people who believe you have to wear a mask to protect yourself from yourself when you're driving down the road in a car. In any case, welcome back to the program. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, and on days like today, with Joe Biden dipping into our emergency strategic reserve of petroleum to try to drop the price of gas 10 cents a gallon, if it even has that much effect, I suspect it will not. I'd be glad to take those naysayer calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our Twitter poll today: should Northwest states develop vaccine passports? Now, I'd say no, because the vaccine passport, even in some of the most liberal communities and states in America, people have rejected the idea of having to walk around with your papers, please, and have authorities demand them from you. Well, guess what? A tip from a loyal Lars listener, Oregon is quietly working on a digital vaccine passport, so quietly that when the project reached the public comment stage yesterday, the Oregon Health Authority failed to promote it on their Facebook page or on Twitter or even on the OHA website. Registration is very limited. It's already closed. Even OHA employees have not been told about the program in staff meetings where they usually brag about everything they're working on. No doubt it is being contracted out. Be interesting to see when the state finally springs it on everybody and says, by the way, we got a big surprise for you. We've developed a vaccine passport. And yes, we've already given the public a chance to comment on it officially if they knew exactly where to look. So should Northwest states develop vaccine passports? It appears that the Oregon Health Authority is doing exactly that, but they're doing it on the QT. Today's Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go first to Pete in Medford. Hey, Pete, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Yes. I wonder why these DAs, due to their lax prosecution, turning these criminals back on the street, cannot be sued by the victims.
I think because if there is general immunity given to everybody who's in elective office, if they operate under the legal rules that are on the books. So, for example, if a police officer goes out and does his job, in most cases, he has a fair amount of immunity if he's operating within the training and the rules of the department. So if a police officer takes somebody into custody, he may get sued, but there's a fair amount of protection in the law. And I think there ought to be a fair amount of protection in the law. If a police officer on duty went out and robbed a bank, he'd be outside of the laws. And certainly he could be convicted of a crime and he could probably be sued if he did things outside the color of law. But for the most part, when a DA says we're either not going to prosecute people, as so many liberal DAs have done, like Mike Schmidt in Portland and like Pete Holmes, the city attorney in Seattle, where they simply say we're not going to prosecute those people, it's virtually impossible to sue them. So they have a lot of immunity. You're absolutely right.
Thanks for your answer, Lars. I was afraid that was the case.
No worries. Hey, by the way, I'm going to ask the guys in the studio, can we jump to the White House briefing room right now? It looks like Jen Psaki, Peppermint Patty, is answering questions about how Joe Biden is going to bring the price of gasoline down. Can we jump into that briefing for just a moment? I think she's still talking about this. People are trying to figure out what Joe's doing.
Several weeks as these discussions have happened, and as other countries have announced parallel releases, we've seen the oil prices go down about 10%. But I don't have anything to predict, preview, or rule out for you here today.
Just two more quick follow-ups. The Japanese were quoted this morning as saying they weren't certain yet when or how they would do this. So who exactly has committed, other than us, to doing this?
Well, I think, one, there have been a number of countries who have already announced planned releases, including China, including India, Japan, Japan, I think, has the intention to, the Republic of Korea, and the United Kingdom. So there are a number of countries that either have or will. That's part of the discussions we've had. I don't want to obviously speak for them. These are just the countries we've had discussions with, I should say, to be more specific.
Yes, there's no confusion. You are not the spokesperson for the
No, I have enough on my plate.
And then just real quick, you keep mentioning, and others have mentioned, this letter from the FTC, or to the FTC.
Yeah.
Have you heard back from the FTC?
They're obviously an independent actor, and we will let them speak for themselves. I would point you to the fact that we sent a letter to them earlier this year where we expressed a concern about kind of monopolies or oil conglomeration of oil companies. That's something they responded and took action, but I would point you to them for any intention of their response. Go ahead.
Thanks, Jen. A couple days ago, President Biden was in Michigan.
Oh, this
and
is
he
juicy.
Was thanking Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib for the passport into her district. Now she is supporting legislation that would release all federal prisoners within 10 years. Would the president ever support that?
Well, the president did enjoy visiting Michigan and visiting Congresswoman Tlaib's district. But let me be absolutely clear. The president does not support abolishing prisons. He does not support defunding the police. He thinks measures like that will make us less safe, and he would not support legislation that includes it. What he does support is effective and accountable community policing and a fairer justice system, and he supports investment in public health, education, the environment, housing, community-based programs. But he knows there are steps, and he believes there are steps that we know are going to reduce crime and make our neighborhoods safer, but that is not one of them in his view.
Another topic. Would the president ever apologize to the acquitted Kenosha shooter Kyle Rittenhouse for suggesting online and on TV that he is a white supremacist?
Well, let's be clear what we're talking about here. This is about a campaign video released last year that used President Trump's own words during a debate as he refused to condemn white supremacists and militia groups. And President Trump, as we know from history and as many of you covered, didn't just refuse to condemn militia groups on the debate stage.
She's asked a question about Joe Biden and she answers
about
Donald Trump, of course.
So, you know, what we've seen are the tragic consequences of that. When people think it's okay to take the law into their own hands instead of allowing law enforcement to do its job. And the president believes in condemning hatred, division, and violence. That's exactly what was done in that video.
How about an apology for calling Kyle Rittenhouse a white supremacist?
You're saying it was just a campaign video. It wasn't. The president also gave an interview where he said this Rittenhouse was part of a militia coming out of Illinois. Have you ever heard this president referring to Trump say one negative thing about white supremacists? These are all things. None of this was proven in the trial. And Kyle Rittenhouse is saying that the president had actual malice in defaming his character. Is that what happened here?
The president spoke to the verdict last week. He has obviously condemned the hatred and division and violence we've seen around the country by
She's
groups like
the Proud
Boys.
She's going to dodge that question till the end of the day. Thank you very much. It's the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday and live on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to have you call. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. At the beginning of the program, I played a soundbite of Joe Biden with his cockamamie explanation of how he's going to bring oil prices down. And I got quite a bit of feedback about that. But there was one thing, we were in a hurry to cut the soundbites because he only said this less than about an hour ago. But he played, one of them played, and Lance noticed something that he had said. Can we play that soundbite again on climate measures, if you don't mind?
I also want to briefly address one myth about inflated gas prices. They're not due to environmental measures. My effort to combat climate change is not raising the price of gas or increasing its availability. What it's doing, it's increasing the availability of jobs. Jobs building electric cars like the one I drove at the GM factory in Detroit last week.
Okay, stop right there. Joe Biden is not all there upstairs. Joe Biden, as Lance pointed out to me, and I just, the soundbite went by me. I was focused on him talking about electric cars when I knew that electric cars are 2/3 of the vehicles that are owned by Americans. Americans own about 272 million vehicles, about 2 million of them, less than 2/3 of, or about 2/3 of 1% are electric cars. And I was focused on that. Joe Biden said at, you know, that electric vehicle that I drove at the GM factory in Detroit last week, he drove a vehicle at the Ford factory. But apparently Joe Biden's grasp of what's going on, you go to a factory, you drive an electric vehicle. It's the Ford factory. A week goes by and you're talking about it and you say, yeah, it was at the GM factory. That's the kind of grasp that Joe Biden has of what's going on in his own administration. So, Lance, thank you very much. I had not got that. And then Ben wrote in and said, Lars, I did some math, and Joe Biden's release of the strategic oil reserves amounts to about 3 days of U.S. consumption. I had said 2.5, and I pointed out to you, this country uses between 18 and 20 million barrels a day. Releasing 50 million barrels is releasing 2.5 or 3 days worth of consumption. When you average that into the prices, it is a tiny drop in the bucket. He says this is incredibly insignificant considering his anti-energy policy. I believe the administration believes that other factors will slow gas prices, inflation, but will claim in a few weeks this policy has been successful. Yeah, if you can cut demand dramatically, you can probably get the price to drop right down. The problem is demand has come back up. And as we know, Joe Biden is trying to close down pipeline number 5 that runs from Canada into the United States through the state of Michigan. He's already killed the Keystone XL pipeline. He's killed leasing on federal lands. He's killed many of the ways that this country made itself self-sufficient for oil, natural gas, and all these forms of energy during Donald Trump. We were self-sufficient on the day that Joe Biden took his oath of office. And even today, he said, the only way we can get more oil is if we either raid the cupboard and go into our emergency supplies, which is what Biden is doing right now, or if we go hat in hand to Vladimir Putin or the Saudi sheikhs and ask them to pump more oil. That's the kind of situation we're in. Let's go to Priscilla in Seattle. Hey, Priscilla, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to add that there was a Skyway boy by the name of Elijah Ron Brown, who was killed by he was 12. He was shot by 35-year-old Curtis Brown, and the state paid the family $3 million to Elijah Ron because we had let him out, let Curtis out, and he was on community supervision program. And since he was being supervised by the community was supposed to keep him from killing this 12-year-old boy, and we didn't fulfill that, so we had to pay the family $3 million.
Yeah, in fact, that was, 2010 is when the shooting happened,
2010,
right?
2010, yeah.
And then about 4 years ago, the state of Washington paid $3 million saying, sorry, we let him go. We were supposed to keep an eye on him. And by the way, the man who killed that 12-year-old boy in Skyway, I had forgotten about, I know we talked about it at the time. He killed him. He was a gang member, and he mistook the 12-year-old for somebody else and thought, that's the guy I want to get. And he murders a 12-year-old boy by accident, but he did murder him.
Right.
Ugh.
So sorry.
And the taxpayers are on the hook for it. Thank you, Priscilla. Let's go to Don, who's a naysayer. Hey, Don, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Lars, I hate to correct you, but the president did drive an electric Hummer at a GM plant a couple of days ago. Saw a video. It's a white one. He drove it. Now, he did drive an electric Ford Lightning a few weeks ago at a Ford plant.
Last week,
but it's been a couple more than that. But the GM was GM Hummer.
He drove the Ford on the 18th, So he drove the Ford and then he motor recently drove the GM. So both the listener and I were wrong about it.
Fair point. GM is just really doing the great thing with electric vehicles, and yet at the LA show last week, they didn't have any electric cars. Of course, Tesla does have a few, though.
That's a fair point. Thank you, Don. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's a pleasure to be with you. If you want to jump in to the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And it's a pleasure to welcome back one of the candidates who is running to replace Kate Brown as governor of Oregon, Republican Mayor Stan Pulliam of Sandy, Oregon, although I guess as mayor, that's a nonpartisan seat, but you're clearly running for governor as a Republican, are you not, Stan?
That's exactly right. In fact, just last week, we're at the Republican Governors Association meeting where everyone's excited about the Republican wave that's coming to Oregon.
Well, let me ask you about a couple of things that have come up today. Kate Brown's OHA and Kate Brown herself came out today and announced, we're going to drop the outside mask mandate for citizens that they put in place back in August. Nobody, it seems to me, at least from my observation, few people were actually following that mandate anyway. Should it have ever been put in place to begin with?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, I mean, how embarrassing when the governor was just in Washington, D.C. for this infrastructure signing and was asked by a reporter about the fact that there's no end in sight, no timeline to get rid of these masks. And she says, in Oregon, we're going to continue to follow the science, as if we're the only state, you know, that has this magical science that she keeps referring to. And you're right, Lars. I mean, who in their right mind right now is wearing a mask while outdoors? If anything, that's exactly what we've learned is, you know, COVID's not spread outdoors. And why are we stepping all over people's constitutional rights? It's just really unbelievable. We're looking forward to getting rid of all of these mandates.
I am, too, because I'm like you. I've been reading as many studies of the last year and a half as I can. And early on, people are saying, well, maybe a mask will change things. And then as the studies began to come in, they said, well, first of all, we're not seeing much outside transmission of this disease at all. And so, no, I don't think she's following the science. I think she and Jay Inslee just wanted to have the most draconian rules that they possibly could. Let me ask you about another issue, though, and that is illegal aliens. By the end of the year, the estimates are we will have seen 2 million people come across our southern border illegally, not all from Mexico, not even all from Central or South America. They are from a total of about 150 different countries around the world. And for the most part, we don't know specifically where they're going. The Biden administration may know where they're going because they're providing the airplane rides and the bus rides and everything else. Is this creating a problem for the Pacific Northwest that some of these people are coming here, whether it's being made public or not?
Absolutely, Lars. You know, I mentioned I was just gone at the Republican Governors Association meeting. So it was in Arizona. While there, I had the opportunity to go to near the border in Pinal County to Casa Grande with Sheriff Mark Lamb, who's on the front lines of this. And, you know, the real point that he reiterated over and over again is that these problems at the border are coming to places like Oregon. And you know, Lars, we're already seeing it. I mean, think about what we've seen in Pinal County. So in 2018, zero fentanyl pills seized. 2019, 677. 2020, over 200,000 pills seized. And we've already seen over 1.1 million in August. Now, that's there in Arizona near the border. We're already seeing this coming to Oregon. We're seeing the seizures that are going up rapidly. We're seeing the local news covering it. We've lost over 100,000 Americans to these kinds of deaths. And when you think about what we're doing here in Oregon, we've decriminalized drugs. We've created the marketplace for it now for these cartels to come in and to fill it. And I'm telling you, after spending the day with Sheriff Lamb, I mean, I'm more motivated than ever to address this problem because you can see exactly what's happening and how they're funneling these criminals into our country.
All right. Speaking of drugs, there are people who say, well, Lars, you're anti-pot. Look, personally, I don't use this stuff. I didn't vote to legalize it. I didn't think it was a good idea. But I accept that the legislature in the state of Washington, the voters in the state of Oregon have legalized pot. But I said you're going to have some collateral damage from this. And we saw it over the weekend, news of a raid in Southern Oregon by the state police in which they seized $500 million worth of marijuana. And you say, well, who cares? Well, the state is being turned into a massive marijuana farm, and I think Washington State's going to catch a piece of that as well. And we've also talked to sheriffs down there and had them on the show describing the human trafficking, the literal human slavery that's being used to run these farms. So even if you don't care about smoking pot or whether Oregon ends up being the source of pot that's then brought illegally to other states, I don't think we don't appreciate it when the fentanyl comes into our state and kills people or into our region. I don't think the other states that haven't legalized this stuff appreciate Oregon being the source for a drug they've decided not to legalize just yet. So I think you have to have respect for those people. What would you do as governor to shut this down? Because I have a feeling if you're doing $1 billion worth of business, which is the OSP estimate of the amount of marijuana business, for that kind of money, criminals will kill you.
Well, that's exactly right, Lars. And here's the thing. If you're going to legalize something, then you've got to regulate it. You've got to make it a safe environment. You've got to see what's actually going on here. You certainly don't want to deplete your law enforcement and your agencies that are supposed to be enforcing our laws to make sure that it's done right. And we talk about decriminalizing and creating this vacuum that the cartels are filling. Well, Lars, you know, we've just talked about drugs, but what about the human trafficking that you mentioned? We're already hearing the quiet, steady drumbeat from the Willamette Week and others talking about decriminalizing the sex trade. here in Oregon. Well, what's happened with the drugs after we decriminalized it? We saw the cartels come in and fill the vacuum. That's exactly what's going to happen here. You know, Oregonians eventually are going to have to look at the consequences of our actions. So you ask what we're going to do. We've mentioned, you know, we're going to prop up our local law enforcement agencies, beef those guys up. We're going to triple the size of the state police. But we also need to have a conversation about these issues. We'll look to refer back to the voters to set straight the decriminalization of these drugs. You know, I'm one that don't think the voters had an adequate conversation on it. A lot didn't understand the consequences of the actions on that vote. We're certainly seeing it now. I bet you we can get a completely different result on that. But we need to have a dialogue. We have to have leadership on these issues. We have to have people like Sheriff Mark Lamb out in Arizona, who, you know, when I talk to him about what's going on out at the border, he talks about maybe the most important thing he does is raise awareness. Raises awareness of what's happening at the border, raises awareness of the tools and resources that he needs from the federal government and locally to be able to fight back against these cartels. And I'll tell you, Lars, you know, after being out there, you should see the shoes. Everybody's got the same rug carpet shoes that covers their tracks and it's quiet out there. You have the same exact water bottles that they discard when they come in. What does that say to you? It says organized. That it's corporate. It's organized. These cartels are well-ran business machines. They basically have, you know, a package, you know, hand box, a box they hand these guys with all the things they need to get over into this country. We have to come down on it. And I really appreciate governors like Abbott and Noem and DeSantis who send their National Guards, you know, to the border to help, you know, help the issues that are going on over there.
Stan, real quick, before we break, what's the website where people can help out your campaign? Quick.
Yes, StanPulliam.org, Mayor Stan for Oregon on Facebook. We have these video interviews coming up this week. Check it out with Sheriff Mark Lamb in Arizona.
You got it. That's Stan Pulliam. Back in just a moment. I'll get to your calls, and we'll talk about Kyle Rittenhouse next.
On trial in Wisconsin, it was the right to self-defense on trial. Right. And if I was convicted, no one would ever be privileged to defend their life against attackers.
That is Kyle Rittenhouse, and his name and his face and his voice have become familiar to a lot of us. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to have you on board and always glad to take your calls. And I'll get to those calls in just a moment. But Tucker Carlson, a friend over on Fox News, had an interview with Kyle Rittenhouse. I would imagine he'll be making the rounds. As you can imagine, about the last year and a half of his life has been pretty thoroughly ruined by being accused of a crime that he never actually committed. The case, as I've said before, never should have gone to trial, but it was resolved on Friday with an acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse. Does that mean it's over for him? You know, it's not over for him. And in fact, you can imagine what he has gone through. And Tucker got into part of that last night when he talked about the long, long period, almost 3 months that Kyle Rittenhouse spent in jail on those charges, because the judge chose, even though the charges were very thin, even though there was no indication that Kyle Rittenhouse was any kind of flight risk. That is, was he going to show up for court? Of course he was. He was 17 years old at the time he was charged. He's 18 years old now. But he sat in jail a long, long time. Take a listen to that.
How long were you there?
I was in jail for 87 days, and this follows in with Lynn Wood, who Lynn Wood was raising money on my behalf, and he held me in jail for 87 days, disrespected my wishes, put me on media interviews, which I should never have done, which he said, oh, you're going to go talk to the Washington Post, which was not a good idea. Along with John Pierce, they said I was safer in jail instead of at home with my family.
Now, it's interesting because his prior attorneys, Lynn Wood included among them, Lynn Wood is one of those attorneys whose name became familiar during the 2020 November 3rd election because Lynn Wood was one of those people challenging the election. But that was just one of the cases he was involved in. He was originally Kyle Rittenhouse's attorney. Rittenhouse doesn't have much good to say about Lynn Wood, and I would imagine there may even be a lawsuit because he thinks he was not represented well. But take a listen to what Kyle says about this. Take a listen to the next soundbite, please.
It wasn't Kyle Rittenhouse on trial in Wisconsin. It was the right to self-defense on trial.
Right.
And if I was convicted, no one would ever be privileged to defend their life against attackers.
Yeah, that was the soundbite we played earlier. Thank you very much. In any case, glad to have you with me on a Tuesday. Glad to take your phone calls and your emails. Our Twitter poll today, should Northwest states develop vaccine passports? I'd say no to that. I got tipped by a listener who says that Oregon's health authority is quietly working on a digital vaccine passport, one that you would load on your phone. And this tipster tells me, so quietly, when the project reached the public comment stage today, the Oregon health authority failed to promote it on their Facebook page or on Twitter or even on the OHA website. And even OHA employees have not been told about the program in staff meetings, where they usually brag about what they're working on. No doubt it may be contracted out elsewhere. It would be an interesting piece of technology. I think it is absolutely the wrong thing for the state of Oregon to do. And yet, when you look at the activities of both Jay Inslee in Washington State and Kate Brown in Oregon, they have chosen to be the two governors out of 50 who have chosen to adopt and press forward with the most draconian rules you can possibly imagine, that they press forward with rules that make no sense. In fact, Kate Brown just gave one of them up today, said, gee, you can go outside in crowded areas like going shopping or going to some event somewhere without wearing a mask. I think most people had already given up wearing the masks, and they realized we're not going to catch COVID outside. This is a stupid rule. And when government adopts stupid rules, I think citizens are smart enough to say, I'm just not going to do it that way. 866-HEY-LARS is the number to call. If you want to vote in our Twitter poll, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. If you don't like Twitter, go to my website at LarsLarson.com. And brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go first to Richard. Hey, Richard, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network.
Well, thank you, Lars. How are you doing today?
Not too bad. What's on your mind?
Well, I was talking to your screener about the voting issues that we have. Of course, the last major election with the presidents we had, there was all kinds of cheating by the Democrats. But I think there's a technology that's up and coming. This actually might be a little bit of an advanced conversation, but I think decentralized, open ledger, smart contract platforms like blockchain is a solution to the voting problem and governance in general overall.
Okay, but hold on, Richard. How would this actually work? In other words, how would we conduct an election? I've had my own ideas for how we might merge technology with elections, but I'd like to understand how this is going to work. Just saying blockchain. Blockchain's a great way of doing, you know, of keeping track of things. But how would that work for actually casting a ballot?
Smart contracts. They're contracts written in computer code, and they're self-fulfilling.
Look
at NFTs and what NFTs, non-fungible tokens, they're undividable and unreplicatable. So if each individual citizen had an NFT for being a U.S. citizen, once that NFT was used on a voting platform, it could be never used again. And then once you die, it gets burned. It's gone permanently. Not like a social security number that can be reused by multiple Mexicans.
Great idea. Now, in an environment where the Democrats don't even want you to demand picture ID of voters, what's the likelihood that you're going to get a system adopted? And it would have to be adopted state by state, unless you're talking about having the federal government impose it, which I'm not in favor of. But let's say you did. How would you go about getting the powers that be to say, yes, we'll not only require that people prove they're a citizen of the United States, but that they get this NFT assigned to them, assigned for life, and when they die, it goes away, although I don't know how you make sure that it goes away. How would you go about doing that?
See, I'm not super technical on the whole technology issue. I would suggest you contact like Charles Hoskinson.
Well,
he's the creator of Cardano, and he'd be able to explain it a lot better.
Okay, because you're pitching an idea, but then saying, "But I don't understand how it works." If you say,
"I understand how it works," but I'm not literate enough to be able to explain it to you in a couple of minutes. All I can say is they're smart contracts.
All right.
that are written in computer code and self-fulfilling by themselves.
And they'd be assigned
and we can make
to each
rules
person
without rulers and govern without government.
Okay, but hold on. We'd get rid of government?
It's being done in Miami right now currently.
Okay. I'll take a look at it, Richard. I'd be glad to read more about it and find out. The only problem is you've got a political environment where the Democrats will not accept even identifying a voter, saying you have to show that you are legally in the United States before you're allowed to register to vote. What we do is we just trust that anybody who's already here and signs a piece of paper, and we should assume that if they sign it, they must be telling the truth. And as we found out in November, that isn't always the case. But thanks for the call. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Now, a lot of Americans got understandably angry, including yours truly, when we heard that the Biden administration was planning to give $450,000 each to illegal aliens who are crossing our border. And we said, well, that's outrageous. And then we found out, no, it's not $450,000 per illegal alien, because Joe Biden said it isn't exactly that number. He made a denial. The denial didn't stick. And finally, he was forced to admit that, yes, the DOJ was negotiating to pay monies to people who were separated, not the tens of thousands of children who came across the border since Joe Biden took the oath of office. No, this would only apply to those who came across the border during Donald Trump's time in office and were separated from their parents. And I pointed out to you that when criminals commit crimes in America and they have children with them, frequently, almost always, the children are separated from the parents. It's nothing new, and it's nothing that doesn't happen to American citizens as well. But I thought I'd talk to Josh Smith about this from the Center for Growth and Opportunity. We finally got the DOJ to admit, yes, we are negotiating the exact amount of money we'd pay to illegal aliens for this supposed trauma of being separated from their kids because of their own criminal activities. We are going to pay them some money. And then the story kind of faded into the background. Josh, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Lars. Thanks for having me.
So do we know anything more about exactly how much money is going to be paid? And why would we be paying people who came across the border illegally, brought their kids or somebody's kids with them? They could have easily been kids that were being trafficked by the Mexican drug cartels or the cartels that get illegals across the border. Why would we pay them for being separated when that's the only choice that you have under the law for the safety of the children? And what should we be doing instead of paying illegal aliens hundreds of thousands of dollars for breaking our laws?
I think this is an anchoring, it's negotiations 101. You've got a high number that you want to start the conversation out at so that you can make a big payout for your clients. But what we really should be focused on is modernizing the U.S. immigration system to sell visas, and then we can use that money to help people who have been left behind by globalization. Our research suggests we could sell those visas for about $80,000 a piece and raise in total $67 billion to spend out helping someone who maybe used to work for a manufacturing company that has since gone out of business because of globalization.
So we could actually, we would sell U.S. visas. We'd allow, are you comfortable with that idea?
I think this is a great way to start enabling the U.S. economy to bring in the best and brightest. So think about this example. Eric Yuan, who founded Zoom, the teleconferencing software, he applied 8 times to come to the country. 8 times he was denied. On the 9th time, he finally got it right, got in. But you can imagine it'd be much easier for U.S. investors, for U.S. people to bring people with bright ideas here if instead of having to apply and let a bureaucrat search through the paperwork and decide if all of the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, we could say, you know what, if I'm an investor, I can buy Eric Yuan a visa because I think this is a promising idea. That's going to make the U.S. economy competitive.
Because we actually see this on a small scale, Josh. I can remember a restaurant that there were a lot of stories done on. I didn't do the stories, but I was interested in them. The restaurant said, we want some authentic Thai cooks, you know, from Thailand. And they said, but we can't find the people with the skills here. So they paid for the kind of visa to bring somebody in who has specific skills. and then that person had to work for them for a period of time. It's not quite indentured servitude. It kind of has a whiff of indentured servitude about it, but both parties benefit. The restaurant owner benefited, and the people who were brought here benefited, and that would be an example where you don't necessarily have to be a brilliant computer coder like the guy who invented Zoom. You could just be somebody with skills that are actually needed here, and skills that would make sure that these people are unlikely to become a public charge, like so many of the illegals who come across the border without any screening.
That's right. There's already an existing program that does something like this called the EB-5 program, technically, or yep, more broadly known as the investor visa. And so there, if you invest $500,000 in an economically distressed area, then you get a visa to come in. If you invest $1 million somewhere else in the country, you can come in. But that's a relatively small program. And this is an opportunity to be able to raise something much more like $67 billion. I think the EB-5 program raises only a fraction of that.
So would we make entry to the United States and green card status exclusively paid for, or just a lot of it paid for, but we would still grant visas to people who would come in and not pay anything or not pay nearly as much?
I think it makes sense to have visa programs on both ends of the skill spectrum. So you can think about the H-2A or H-2B visas that are for low-skilled agricultural work or seasonal work and hospitality, compared to something like the H-1B program, which brings in lots of people with PhDs and graduate degrees. So I think of this as much more replacing a program like the H-1B, which hasn't been fully updated since when it was first instituted in 1990. So we really need to get behind modernizing the immigration system to work for all of us.
You know, some of that is appealing, Josh, but some of it makes me uncomfortable this way, because it suggests that there are people out there who run business enterprises who say, I don't want to pay the wages I'd have to pay to get an American to come and do this job, even though we know that there are millions of Americans who do need to go to work. You know, they're not independently wealthy. We don't want them living on the public dole. They are capable of work. I'm not talking about the old or the very, very young. I'm not talking about any of those or people who are physically or mentally incapable of doing the work. And when we import the labor for those kinds of jobs, aren't we undercutting any ability for Americans to do those jobs instead?
You're totally right. That's why right now is a great time to start expanding immigration, because we have 10 million unfilled positions and only 7 million unemployed persons in the country. So any way you cut it, we are missing 3 million people, according to the most recent Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers. So you're totally right. Right now, across the country, we're seeing people raising wages, and the subway here in Logan, Utah, we're a small little town, university town, and the subway is offering a $500 signing bonus for anyone who will come and work for 3 months. And so there's definitely a need for more workers. And I think one of the benefits of starting to sell visas is we're able to use funds. So you can help out someone who maybe didn't graduate high school and train them to be an electrician or a plumber. You could put them through several years of college with $80,000. So I think it's a really promising opportunity to help modernize the immigration system and help some people who have been left behind.
Okay, and that's fair enough. Now, is anybody actually pitching this idea in the current Congress, or do we have to wait for the Republicans to take control of the Congress next fall?
There have been some proposals like this in the past. The fundamental idea comes from Gary Becker, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics 30 or 40 years ago. So there's been an idea out there, but you know, our door is always open here at TGO, and I'd be happy to talk to anyone who's interested in developing what the program would look like in practice.
You know, because I've often compared this, Josh, I've said, look, we've got one of the most exclusive clubs in the world, and that is, if you just live in the United States, you're not a PhD, you're not wealthy, you're not any of that, you're luckier than most of the people on the planet, because we recognize you have rights that come from God, they're protected by the Constitution, we have a fairly reliable court system, it does have its flaws. But just living here is a privilege. And then we say, and who should we give that to? And currently the Biden administration is saying anybody who can stumble across the border into McAllen, Texas can get that. And you say, I think we could be a little choosier than that and benefit not only them, but also benefit the people in this country as well. Thanks so much for the time, Josh. That's Josh Smith with the Center for Growth and Opportunity. What do you think about that idea? the idea that maybe we should charge something. If you want to come to the United States and you have skills and talents, is it worth a few dollars to make it happen? And could we benefit other people that way as well? We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. We serve the Pacific Northwest with honestly provocative talk radio. And we were talking about visas a moment ago. Should Northwest states develop vaccine passports? In other words, you want to give Jay Inslee and Kate Brand the chance to say, we can demand of citizens, your papers, please. And if you don't show it, well, why is the Oregon Health Authority keeping this project so quiet? We actually know the name of the coding guy who is actually writing the software. But should Northwest states develop vaccine passports? My answer to that would be no, even though apparently Oregon Health Authority is very quietly coming up with a plan. Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. I had a naysayer up, and apparently he went away. Deanna, that does not make you my second choice. You are my choice. Welcome to the program, and what's
Hi,
on your
Lars.
Mind?
Hi. Good afternoon to you.
You bet.
So I was listening to your show and heard the entire segment of the man, Josh Smith. And I could not believe what I was hearing. We have so many people. I am out sick today from my job. But I have to go run some errands. I just drove by 13th Avenue by the Lane County Fairgrounds, and there's 100 or more tents there. We need to help our own citizens. $80,000, if you took a poll of anyone who's crossed the border, I'll bet you there's nobody that has $80,000 in cash to pay the government, or, you know, whoever. He's talking about people investing in citizens. You know, they could invest in their own citizens and help our economy.
I'm not sure why
people won't go back to work, but...
I know why. I think I know why, Deanna. Do you think that every one of those people in the tent at the fairgrounds that you drove by today is getting about four or five different government programs that are paying them not to work?
I don't know. I'm sure
Maybe they're getting food stamps. That's one. How about Medicaid? So you're paying for their health insurance. I'll bet you earn your health insurance at work. They're getting it out of your paycheck. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, taxes are high enough. We all know that.
They'll get higher under Biden because Biden's going to shovel out more money. And so, Deanna, if all those people in tent say, hey, Deanna, I mean, if they knew what was going on, they'd say, Deanna, thanks a lot. I'm getting food stamps from you. I'm getting medical care from you. I may be getting TANF, what we used to call welfare, but they keep changing the name because they say welfare sounds demeaning. So then they call it something else, and they keep changing the name as though that's going to change the nature of being on the dole. That all comes out of your paycheck. They should be thanking you for that, but they're just saying, no, I'm entitled to this, and I don't have to go to work.
Well,
did you see very many of those people
didn't
look capable of working, Deanna?
Lars, I have been a single mom, and I've been on some of those programs, but I worked, you know, I pulled myself up, basically, got out of
that
system.
And you're not on
them anymore, right? I was never homeless. You know, struggled with being a single parent, but I don't know the answer, but I just think investing in, you know, you're one person. I'm going to pay $80,000 for you to come over here.
They're not going to pay that. They're saying the person who wants to come here, let's say you've got somebody in China who has technical skills or some another country, and they say, if I could just get to the United States and go to work for Microsoft or Boeing or Intel, I could make a lot of money, but I have to get there. Well, do they get in line with everybody else and we just take them no matter, I mean, in other words, there is a massive line in most countries to come into this country legally. You go to the U.S. Embassy and they say you're going to be waiting for 7 or 8 years in many cases because there's a long line of people ahead of you. What if you could go through that line and say, this person, this man or woman would be great because they have skills, they have talents. We want those skills and talents here. We'd like to bring them in. And then Microsoft says, hey, I tell you what, you bring that person in, we'll put them right to work, and we'll pay the $80,000. Somebody pays the money. Now, when you talked about the illegals, you are aware the illegals pay the coyotes up to $10,000 to get them across the border. So they're paying. They're just not paying the United States for it.
Well,
that's
I guess
what
it all boils down to is that money talks, and I don't know. I don't agree with his idea, but respect his opinion, of course, okay?
Yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, look, I don't agree with necessarily all of it. I don't want to see Americans displaced, but do you think any one of those people you drove past in the tent today could go down and get a job today?
Well, not like they are.
Oh, hold on.
You know.
Well, I mean, if you go to work in a warehouse and your job is to move things from this place to that place, there are tons of those jobs available right now. Right?
I don't know. I don't know the answer, and I don't know why people can't, you know, clean up.
Because if you had a brother-in-law who came to live at your house because he said he was on hard times, and a month in he said, I don't feel like going to work. I've got your refrigerator and your couch right here. Would you tell your brother to get off the couch?
Yeah, probably.
Absolutely. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And you might say, Lars, you've been a real critic of electric buses. And I have been when they're used for city bus transportation systems because I don't think they pencil out. But then I saw that there is a proposal, I guess it's actually going to become reality, to have an electric bus that would run all the way from, what, Seattle, or then to Portland, and then all the way to Eugene. And I thought, perhaps in that kind of situation, you might even be able to make the thing pencil out. So I thought we've got to talk to the guy involved, and that's Pierre Gourdain, who joins me now, managing director of an entity called Flixbus USA. Mr. Gourdain, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
So tell me about this Flixbus. What is it, and where are you operating already, and how are you bringing this to the Northwest?
So Flixbus is the largest bus brand and bus platform in the world. And being in 2021, like many of our startup veterans, we are not really running and operating buses ourselves. We are really supporting small and local businesses who want to get into the fray and want to start their own bus routes, and we're basically empowering them through a very strong tech platform that basically allows them to run routes and to connect to a network that spans more than 30 states in the U.S. and about countries globally. We just started about 10 years ago, and in the U.S. we launched in 2018, 2019 in the Pacific Northwest. So just getting started. And now we are very excited because we will be writing history this Sunday, which is the first intercity and all-electric bus route in this country in the great state of Oregon and Washington.
Yeah, because your route, and by the way, I've got no dog in the fight out. I always tell my audience whether I've got a financial interest or anything. I'm just curious about it, and I get to do this through the show. You're going to run all the way from Seattle, a stopover in Portland, and then run all the way to Eugene. And you're going to do that on a daily basis?
No, for now it's just a pilot. It will just run this Sunday, leaving 8 a.m. in Seattle. It's going to get into Portland a bit before 11:30. And then the issue is that the electric bus cannot get you to, it's just too far. So the bus will need to stop in Portland, charge for a few hours, and then it's leaving for Eugene about 2.5 hours later. So what the diesel bus can do, electric bus cannot do yet. And this is also one of the reasons we are not running those buses. Our partner, MTR, is not running those buses full-time. Still a work in progress. We hope, however, that by maybe next year, and a bit of an, we haven't yet, but let's say the latest next year, you will have electric buses running, hopefully, between Seattle, Portland, and Eugene on a daily basis. And I hope that the Northwest will be the first place in the U.S. to have it.
Okay, so and this will be a commercial enterprise, or is it being run by government or a nonprofit? How does that work?
So it is a commercial enterprise. Actually, I'm a French tree hugging socialist. So I'm probably on that spectrum. I'm probably on the other opposite. So I actually think that it would be even better if we could get some subsidies for it. And as it happens, our partner is asking for subsidies, but we believe that it pencils out that you can run an electric bus. And more importantly, Lars, we believe that you can finally make this amazing technology available for everyone, available for the people. Right now, if you want to drive electric, to drive clean, you have to be upper middle class, or you have to be rich, you have to be able to afford, if you can put your hands on one, a $40,000 car. Now, with Flixbus, with our partner MTR, the tickets start at just $24.99, and you can really enjoy the silence. It's really a better ride. It's a better experience. And I believe it's the future, and it will actually bring more people to the bus product.
Well, see, I have to explain. I'm a thoroughgoing capitalist, but I always look forward to the opportunity to get real socialists to come on the program because, because I'm amazed. I look at them and I just wonder, how do you make any of this work? I'm not the biggest fan of subsidies at all. If we could get rid of all subsidies and make everything except charity pay for itself. Charity can be charity, but everything else should pay for itself. So we come from opposite ends of the spectrum, but if you can make it work, I mean, I guess more power to you. At this point, it works without subsidies, or could work without subsidies?
Yeah, we believe it. We believe it could. We haven't done it yet, right? So we have to run that one bus. You know that more people, more Americans have been in space than people have run on a city-to-city trip between on an all-electric bus trip. So it was never done before. It's really a big, big step. And in a way, thanks a lot for having us as well, because and giving more visibility to this what's really a crazy idea. When we started discussing it 2 years ago, we thought it wouldn't happen before 25. We ran the first empty bus 2 years ago. Now we run a bus with passengers, and we hope that 2022 will have the first full-fledged normal routes running. And yes, if we want to just deep dive a little bit on the cost end of things, it basically comes down to, can you find cheap charging? Basically, can you find and can you share access infrastructure? So there is a bit of a sharing economy mindset here, where If we are able, our partner can basically afford one charger in Seattle. He still needs to find someone who can let him charge his bus, even if he needs to pay, maybe in Portland and probably another one in Eugene. And if we can find partners, maybe public partners, maybe transit, who can basically put charging infrastructure at the disposal of the partner, then we think it can pencil out. It will be more expensive to buy the bus. The bus is, to give you an idea, twice as expensive. It's $1 million bus.
Yep.
The most expensive coach you can buy in America right now. And basically, you make up for it on the gas price, because as you know, gas now is here in California is $5 a gallon, right? So it's quite quick. And then you make up in maintenance, because the motor of a bus is just a bit like a small suitcase. And there are so many less parts to change and to maintain. And we also believe that, and we need that to pencil out, but we also believe that people are ready to pay a bit more to have a cleaner air and a quieter ride. So we actually believe it's going to be a good business, and that if we are the first to the market, we would benefit from it, and that people would be ready to pay even a bit more for that. But even if they don't, even if it's the same price as your normal Flixbus, which, by the way, has been running now for 2 years and is a great business venture, then it will still work.
Well, I mean, I have to say that's one of the biggest hang-ups that I've had is the time to charge, especially if you're going those long distances. Pierre Gourdain is the managing director of Flixbus USA. And no, I don't have a dog in the fight, but you can hear the problem. Seattle to Portland, just fine. But then hours of charging, and then you can head on to Eugene after that. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and we just got word on a change that's coming from the White House, from President Joe Biden. And this is, all, in all seriousness, has broke within the, about the last hour and a half. And I don't know how much effect it's going to have on people in the United States who would travel into other countries, think Canada in this case. But for Canadian truckers who come into the United States, I may get a few phone calls from those folks. Listen to this carefully, because I had to look at it a couple of times to decide, what does this apply to? President Joe Biden plans to require essential, so that means most truck drivers are considered essential, non-resident travelers. So you don't live in the United States, you're not a U.S. citizen or green card, crossing U.S. land borders. Think about the border crossing north of Seattle, about 2.5 hours north of Seattle, such as truck drivers and emergency response officials must be fully vaccinated beginning on January 22. Now, this just came out of the White House, as I said, less than 90 minutes ago. President Joe Biden plans to require essential non-resident travelers crossing U.S. land borders, such as truck drivers and emergency response officials, to be fully vaccinated beginning January 22. Now, why is this important? Well, we've heard a lot of talk about whether or not they're going to make the vaccine mandate apply to truckers. America's trucking industry is already around 30% short of what they would consider full, the number of truck drivers that they need to have. And they've done surveys. The professional organizations that represent truckers have asked the truck drivers, if there's a vax mandate, are you going to take the jab? And somewhere around 37%, not quite 40%, of the existing truck drivers have already said, no, I'm not taking it. I'm not doing the jab. So the White House has been wrestling with that. They are now going to impose this. It sounds like if you're a truck driver from Alberta, Canada, and you routinely drive cargo into Washington State or go down to pick up cargo, if you are an essential non-resident, meaning you don't live in the United States, you live in Canada, traveler crossing U.S. land border, like a truck driver or an emergency response official, that you have to be vaccinated starting on January 22. So that only addresses the non-resident truckers. It doesn't go after the truck drivers in the United States. And right now, the trucking industry has been telling the White House, don't go that direction. We're already short of drivers to begin with. If you want to be shorter still, about 37% of our members have already said, we're not going to do this. Now, let me go to your calls. Ron's on the line. Hey, Ron, I take it you called in because you told the producers you want to talk about blockchain voting, which another caller had brought up the idea of blockchain voting. Welcome to the program, and what's on your mind?
Well, I think the blockchain voting, I don't know as much about it as he was explaining, but it sounded pretty good to me. And I just, you know, Lars, I hate to say this. I've lived here in Washington State for my entire life. I'm 58 years old. My parents just sold their property. My sister just sold theirs. And I am all set to go myself.
Totally.
Looks like we're leaving this state. And, it's just, you know, I understand the blockchain thing's a great idea. It sounds like it. But, I got to tell you, Lars, for the first time, I didn't vote for a Republican this year.
Who'd you vote last year? You mean last year?
The last ballots we had. I didn't even cast a ballot, the local.
Why not?
And if... Because we have Democrats and Republicans. We don't have Republican Party in this state, and I will never, never vote for a Republican again if they're going to continue to do nothing like they've been doing my entire life. I am not going to stand for this anymore. I am sick and tired of watching the Democrats are the only ones that get anything done, and everything they've done is pathetic. So,
or worse, or damaging. Would you agree that an awful lot of what the Democrats have done this year has been damaging to the country?
It's damaging to the country. It's been damaging to families. Let's face it, they've destroyed our country. And I don't know we're going to make it to 2024.
Look, I share your concern, but I don't know how do you solve that problem when you say, then I'm just not going to take part. I'm just going to let it. I mean, to me, it would be like being in the car and you're driving down the road and things are going wrong. So you just let go of the wheel and say, okay, I'm no longer in charge. Whatever the car does is what it does, because that's where we are. If you've said, I'm not even going to participate. That's my view.
Right. Right. It serves no purpose to have your hand on the wheel if the car don't move when you turn the wheel. I mean, the Republicans need to get off their butts and start doing something.
Agreed.
That they say that they're going to do, or I will probably, I hate to say this, Lars, you're going to probably not like me for this, but if I'm here at the midterms when I move this summer, if I'm still here finishing up and I do get the vote in the midterms, I'm going to, for the first time, to actually check boxes down the row for Democrats. This state seems to love communism. They pushed it on me for 58 years. I'm going to push it back on them as I'm leaving.
Oh, hold on. Oh, I see what you're saying. You're going to vote for the communists who are running because that'll push us into the wall faster. I've heard this theory before that maybe if we hit the wall fast enough and hard enough that we can actually start to fix the problem. It's an interesting approach, but Ron, thanks for the call. Let's go to Dan. Hey, Dan, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Well, good afternoon, Lars. Happy Thanksgiving and a Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to you and Happy Thanksgiving to you and yours. What's up?
So, quick little story here. I went into my local credit union last Friday to deposit some money.
Yeah.
And I walked in there without wearing a mask. Well, little gal who was at the drive-in window said, I'll be right with you. And then this little 20-something kid comes to another window there and says, I'll help you here. So I walked up and he says, where's your mask? I said, I don't have one. He said, well, you got to have one. I said, no, I don't. He said, why? I said, because it's against the Constitution of the United States of America. Quote, he says, I really don't care about that.
Well, that shouldn't surprise you, should it?
I wanted to reach over that counter, drag that little turd up, and beat the snot out of him.
Well, at that point, Dan, unfortunately, I've got to jump out of that call before we get into trouble with the federal government. Let's go to Matthew. Hey, Matthew, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Holy crap, that was pretty quick, Lars.
It was.
What's on my mind today is, I just heard briefly one of the callers mention that a caller before called and told you about blockchain voting, but I didn't catch it to see what he had told you about.
He didn't have the details. He said, look, it sounds like a great technology. I said, how does it work in practice? Because even if you're already in a state like Oregon or Washington that has vote by mail, how do you apply blockchain? He said, well, you get everybody to prove that they're legally in the United States. And I said, well, stop right there, because right now the Democrats are going to fight tooth and nail against any attempt to make people identify themselves as legal voters.
Yeah, that's true. It's
so you're kind of stopped at go, aren't you?
Yeah. It's tough to get the whole identification and, you know, proof of residents and stuff like that. So that's a little bit over my head, but as far as blockchain goes, it's a public ledger, so it's open and transparent. Everybody,
welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I know that some of you will think, well, you just don't like Joe Biden. I don't care about Joe Biden. I just think he makes bad decisions for America, and some of his bad decisions started on day one. He took the oath, and then he canceled the Keystone XL pipeline, which I thought was not only a great project, but it was essential for the United States. And since then, he's been trying to close an oil pipeline that's been in place already, pipeline number 5 that runs in from Canada to the United States. He has done everything he can to hold back the development of the energy that runs this country. And now he's run into a political problem. Gasoline prices are through the roof. So is diesel. It's essential to run our entire society. And his solution is to dip into the reserves. We have about 600 million barrels, apparently. And he's going to free up 50 million barrels and put that out there saying that'll bring the price down a little bit. Well, I thought I'd talk to a guy who knows more about this than I do, and that's Daniel Turner, who's president of Power of the Future. Daniel, welcome back to the program. And is 50 million barrels going to make a difference? When I look up the number and I see that that's about 2.5 days of the use of this country of oil?
That's a great point you raised, Lars. And first off, thanks for having me back on.
You bet.
And it won't make a difference. And proof of that is the fact that just a few hours ago, the Secretary of Energy, Jennifer Granholm, was giving a press conference at the White House. And she was asked, how many million barrels a day do we use as a country? And she said, I don't know the answer to that.
What?
So if the Secretary of
Hold on. A dumb talk show host knows how many barrels we use a day and the Energy Secretary doesn't?
And if the Energy Secretary doesn't know the answer to that question, then the follow-up, which was, well, then why is 50 million the right number, is a moot point. And I'm sure the journalist who asked that question will never be called on again when Secretary Granholm is giving a conference. So, no, 50 million, why did they choose that number? They chose that number because, as you mentioned, they have made a series of terrible decisions, punitive decisions, and now they look weak. And so they said, boy, we better do something. And so this is what they decided to do. But it's not based on science. It's not based on economics. It's just purely arbitrary decisions. And that's how this administration works.
By the way, can I throw one other thing at you that I noticed? And I don't know if this will be something Granholm knew about or not. But we filled the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We keep it full, or I suppose we cycle oil through it. It doesn't just sit there indefinitely. But we filled it with mostly fairly cheap oil from the last decade or so when oil prices were low, which I think is smart. You fill your cupboard with emergency supplies when they're inexpensive. You don't go buy them when they're expensive. But they're now dumping it out on the marketplace. And unless oil prices go down magically in the next year or two or three, they're going to have to refill it with more expensive oil, aren't they?
Absolutely. Again, a great point. And so they used our tax dollars to buy the oil to begin with. They put it in these reserves, which are there for emergency purposes. God forbid a war. God forbid a real natural disaster where the administration says the entire state of X does not have food supply. We need to do something. Well, we have the 600 million barrels of oil for emergency purposes. So the taxpayers paid for them to put the oil in reserves. Now they're selling it on the marketplace again with the hopes of taxpayers buying gas at a high price. So it's not even good economics. It's a great economics if the government were a private entity. You buy low, you sell high, you make a profit. But I don't think that's the way it works in government. So it's just bad decisions all around. It has nothing to do with strategy, and it won't do anything to the prices. As you mentioned, so many decisions were made early on by this administration, and they are all catching up to them. It wasn't going to happen overnight, but gas prices, little by little, every month have ticked up after 10 months of bad decisions, and that's where we are.
Well, and by the way, one of the things the president just a few hours ago tried to sell was he said, oh, but electric car drivers, they'll be in good shape. So I went and looked those numbers up because I wanted to make sure I had fresh numbers. We have 272 million private automobiles. Government owns about 4 million. So that's 276 in the whole country. How many electric cars as of the most recent number this year? Just 2.13. So just barely over 2 million, or 2/3 of 1% of all the vehicles of the, you know, passenger vehicles. I'm not talking about trucks. Passenger vehicles, yeah. And trucks, you know, pickup trucks and things like that. 2/3 of 1%. And Joe's saying, yeah, but these folks will be fine. I say, yeah, if you happen to be the 2/3 of 1%. And he says, but we're going to have lots of jobs making these cars. And I thought I remembered, and I'll bet Daniel will know, how many of those cars and the batteries and the technology that goes into them are even made in this country as opposed to being made elsewhere?
You're raising so many good points, and these are the points that we have to talk about as a nation. I'm not opposed to electric vehicles. I'm not opposed to wind and solar, but we have to be adults and say there are trade-offs. And one of the trade-offs this administration is asking us to accept is that as they quote-unquote transition to green energy, the American people are going to suffer. I don't think the American people bought this. I don't think they knew this was what's going to happen. And it's not going to be a temporary suffering. It's going to take decades. As you said,
Look at our fleet of vehicles. And first off, your listeners know this. Americans love their cars, right? We have rock yep. songs. We have novels like On the Road that are all about getting in your car and driving somewhere, right? It's part of our culture. Last year, we bought 19 million cars in America. We only bought a few thousand electric. So to say, well, we're just going to switch to electric is not going to happen overnight. Not to mention the Ford F-150 that Joe Biden is so proud of, which is electric, is close to $100,000, where a regular Ford F-150 starts at about $25,000. So who's buying these electric cars?
Rich people.
Yeah.
Rich people.
And exactly.
Well, and the other thing is he'd also driven the GM Hummer. And I thought, well, there, that almost looks like irony as a physical object, because you take one of the most notoriously low mileage vehicles in existence, the Hummer, and you say, let's put electric batteries and electric motors on it. And it's, we're not talking about a little 1800 pound Prius that is half the wind, you know, resistance of a regular car because it's tiny, and then putting batteries in that. We're going to put batteries in a notoriously inefficient vehicle, and it'll be exactly. It'll probably be a big seller for some people, but it's not how you get to energy, you know, to getting everybody into electric cars, is it?
It's not at all. And oil and gas and coal have been huge competitive advantages for America, strategic advantages. Case in point, they keep pointing, the administration, the environment, the left points to how many green vehicles China has, electric vehicles China has. And they keep saying China's doing this because they're responsible or because of climate change. China's doing that because they don't have a lot of oil. They have to import.
They have no oil. Daniel, isn't it true to say China has no domestic oil at all?
Very, very little, and the only bit that they have comes from the western provinces, where the people there have had some skirmishes with the Chinese communist government. Those people are called the Uyghurs, and so they are put in slave camps to get rid of them. So yes, they have basically no oil, and that is a huge vulnerability for China. So if you're Xi Jinping and you see this, you say, boy, I can't rely on the world for oil. What are we going to do? We're going to make electric cars because now we don't need your oil. Smart move for a smart man. America should be doing the same thing 10 times over when it comes to the combustion engine. But as you pointed out, we're buying electric vehicles, most of the parts that are made in China. So we've given up the OPEC cartel for the Chinese cartel.
And meanwhile, the Chinese have plenty of electricity for those electric cars because they're building a coal-fired electric power plant, about one a week right now. And we've made sure that coal is a bargain for them because the United States is moving away from coal, even though we don't have a replacement, so the Chinese can buy it cheaper. Unbelievable. That's Daniel Turner, the president of Power of the Future. Glad to be with you, and I know I'll get a naysayer call or two on that at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And believe me, I make mistakes almost every day, but that's the nature of live radio. But one of the things I like to do with political candidates before I get to this next soundbite is I like to ask them, if you're running for county commission, I'll say to them, okay, how many people are in your county? And if they can't answer, they don't know the job. If I say to them, so you're going to run for a board on the county commission, usually there are five seats on a typical larger county commission, how much money does the county spend every year? Or how many employees do you have? And what are the major functions of your county? And then I usually like to ask, and can you tell me some things the county does that it shouldn't be doing? And that's true of almost every county in America. And certainly here in the Northwest, a lot of counties and cities get involved in things that they shouldn't be doing at all. And I've pointed some of them out. But what happens when you have an energy secretary like Jennifer Granholm, chosen by Joe Biden to head up energy for the entire United States of America? Listen to the question she's asked just a short time ago and listen to her answer.
There are various figures about this, so I'm curious if you know, how many barrels of oil does the U.S. consume per day?
I don't have that number in front of me. Sorry.
So some suggest it's about 18 million, which would suggest you're releasing less than 3 days' worth of supply from the petroleum reserve.
Now, this is what's amazing to me about this. if you have no concept of what your country actually uses in the way of energy, I'm not asking for Jennifer Granholm to know every statistic in the world. But if you say why Joe Biden has decided we're going to release 50 million barrels of oil out of the Strategic Reserve, because that's going to ease the demand. The first thing I thought was, I woke up this morning when I saw that report, I said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to check. I think it's about 20 million. And the numbers vary between 18 and 20 million a day. So you have some idea of what the country consumes. And the first thing that popped in my head is, Joe's going to flush 2.5 days worth of oil into the system, and that's going to make a dramatic difference? I don't think so. It would be like this. If you usually make, say you're the average family in America makes about $4,000 or $5,000 a month. So say a family that makes $4,000 and they say, we're kind of short of money. So you go up and you offer your friend, you say, I heard you're running short on your bills. And you give your friend who makes $4,000 a month, you give him 20 bucks. And you know instinctively that $20 is not going to make a big difference in his life. On the other hand, if you have a friend who, say, makes $10,000 a month, they're a doctor, or they're a nurse, or they're a lawyer, and they make $10,000 or $20,000 a month, and they're short of cash, they're going to need maybe an infusion of $5,000 or $10,000 to make any kind of difference. When you hear that this entire country consumes 18 to 20 million barrels a day, and you say Joe's going to put 50 million barrels in over the next few weeks, you say, that's not going to make any difference at all. But if you're the energy secretary and you don't even know that fact because you don't even have a sense of about how much oil do we use, then you're kind of worthless, aren't you? But I guess that describes most of the Joe Biden candidate, the cabinet. Let's go to Michael, who's a truck driver. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, thanks for taking my call. About that vaccine mandate, I'm an owner-operator. I drive in several states, and back in July and August, I went ahead and got my COVID shots because I drive in several states, and I did it to protect me and my family. Nobody told me to do it. Nobody ordered me to do it, so I just did it for protection on my family.
Understood. That's your decision to make. Do you think everybody else should be able to decide one way or the other whether they get it or not?
Well, of course, but I think because the government ordered people to do it, that's why they're not doing it. So,
some of it is that
they should take their own. Yeah, but everybody needs to do it on an individual basis.
What do you think is going to happen? Because I've seen some of the surveys that the American Truckers Association have put out that say as much as 37 to 40% of truck drivers are going to say, "If you make me take the jab, I'm not doing it, and I'll quit driving."
Yeah, I don't agree with that, but that's just me.
Okay, fair enough. Well, Michael, you got the chance to make the decision for yourself. I think everybody else should, too. Let's go to Stacy. Hey, Stacy, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
I think that we should quit calling these Democrats liberals, because they're not liberals in any way, shape, or form.
You mean in classic terms, because classically liberals were really what we now call conservatives and vice versa, right?
Exactly. They are authoritarians. They're not even socialists anymore. They are authoritarians. And I won't even say the G word. If you look up on the internet, the definition of an authoritarian, it's favoring and enforcing the strict obedience to authority, especially the government.
I agree.
Especially the government. They are authoritarians. They are not liberals in any way, shape, or form.
And they're un-American, Stacy.
Freedom.
They're un-American because I've pointed out to people before, the Constitution has a Bill of Rights. Those are all individual rights. They're not collective rights. They don't say you can practice your religion if you can get 40 people to sit in a church. They say you as an individual have rights. People like Joe Biden, people like the Democrats do not believe in individual rights. They believe in collectivism.